say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you. You put your arms around me, I'm in love with you. You say that you believe me, that our love is true. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you. Your love brings shivers.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have a friend of the show, a pal of the podcast returning. Philip Krimble is here in the studio. Philip, thanks for coming by.
My great pleasure, T. I just love the fact that I'm able to be here doing this with you today, and it's so great to see you again.
Oh, it's so great to see you, and it's a bit of a homecoming coming to Ann Arbor, back to Ann Arbor, isn't it? Via Toronto, via other farther afield places in Canada.
Oh, absolutely. My wife and I have been, traveling all over the city, sort of revisiting our old haunts, and it's been a pleasure. It just feels like there's not nearly enough time.
Oh, and Sarah, I should say, is in the studio audience joining Stephanie behind the glass today. And last night you were at Literati Bookstore.
I was
reading from the book that we have on the table with us today, Not Even Laughter, out with Salmon Press.
Precisely. Yeah, I had a tremendous time. There was a lot of people in the audience, many people that I hadn't seen in quite some time, friends, acquaintances from my time here when I was a student and when I taught as a lecturer at the U. So it was wonderful catching up with everyone.
And you were there with Sarah Messer.
I was, yes, that's right. And I know her a little bit, mostly because when I was a student here, Timothy Liu was our thesis supervisor, and he ran a thesis workshop. And when Tim was here, he did a really remarkable thing in that he brought writers who had just come up with first books into that workshop for us to see, the kind of work that they had produced and the process that went into it. And Sarah Messer was one of those writers.
And had they met during the, was Tim, was he part of the MFA program here earlier?
I think no, was Tim, Sarah? Tim was brought in specifically to lead that workshop for us.
Right. But as a student, I was wondering if he had been here.
I don't think he was a student here, no. I think that his reputation was such at the time, and still, that they felt it would be beneficial to bring him in, and he agreed to it. And, I had a wonderful time in that workshop with him. He really taught us a lot about the sort of nuts and bolts of the business, whereas a lot of workshops don't really do that for you. It's more just about the writing process, of course. But I felt like that final one, that was a really smart way to go about it. It's like, this is how the business works. And Tim really knew a whole lot about that.
How generous of him to have this vision for your final workshop.
Yeah, he came in and he really wanted to do something for us. He wanted to set us up, to give us an opportunity to succeed as writers from the get-go, knowing that it's really difficult once you leave a program like that to keep writing and to try and get your first book published. Of course, I did publish a short collection in 2007.
White Boy.
Right, and of course I was here at that time, like 11 years ago, to talk with you about it. But my very first full-length collection didn't come out until 2015, and I graduated here in 2002. So, I mean, sometimes it takes a long time to get these things down. Sometimes people come up with a book right away. But regardless, I really benefited from what Tim had to say to us.
And can you, what was it like keeping the faith and being a working poet in those intervening years, Philip?
Well, it was difficult at points. I mean, when I was teaching as a lecturer here, there was very, very little time to do other things, as I'm sure you're aware. It's involved. It's all encompassing. And I felt like the summers were my opportunity to do that. So I really devoted myself to writing in the summer. And I felt like I got a whole bunch done in those summers. And the work that I had taken from my MFA and the work that I did over the succeeding 5 years, basically went into my first little collection, and then I just sort of kept building on that from then. You know, I'm doing a PhD now in literature, and again, there's not a whole lot of time for writing, so you have to find time in the evening, time in the early mornings, wherever you can find it. You know, you're focusing on other things.
And right now, you're taking a break. You from the PhD program. I mean, maybe they don't know that you've left town, but you're on a tour, a tour right now. Can you tell us about your path at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. They are aware that I'm gone. And,
this is public, right?
Yeah, sure. It would get probably
just
get
shout
back
out
to them.
To them.
Yeah, hello everyone at the University of New Brunswick. Yeah, so I'm writing my dissertation now. So I have no real responsibilities other than simply doing that. So it's, the responsibilities are my own. And I make my own schedule. So it allows me to do these kinds of things, to take advantage of these sorts of opportunities when they come up. So, you know, I was invited out here to read at Literati, and I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll maybe contact T and see if I could do an appearance on
so
the,
glad you
the
did.
Living Writers. And thank you. And thank you for inviting me to do that, basically at fairly short notice. But I always think, like, you know, why do one or two things when you can do seven or eight? So, right, it's like you're out here anyway. What else can you do? So, you know, actually prior to this, I had been invited to take part in a tour that's going to be happening starting tomorrow and running through the next day, where I'll be making six different appearances. And it's part of a... it's part of like a festival run by the Abel Hamilton Collective. And they're a group that really wants to try and give a voice to disability in poetry specifically. So all of the other writers who are on tour with me have a disability of some sort or another. We're just trying to sort of amplify that voice.
And who do you know some of the other poets off the top of your head, or have you not met them yet, Philip?
Well, I have. I definitely know the organizer, Shane Nielsen, and he's a really intrepid kind of guy. He's a medical doctor, and, you know, he spends a great deal of his time really trying to sort of promote poetry in general, and definitely also promoting the voices of disabled writers. And that's been wonderful that he's been doing that, and there are a whole group of people that he knows that are sort of involved in the collective that are really making this happen. There are some other writers, many of them I don't know that well. I know one of the writers I do know is a gentleman called Mark DeSaverio, and he's an interesting guy. He's a lot of his stuff is sort of patterned after Ezra Pound, from what I know of it anyway, and he's remarkable in that he can you know, rhyme off, you know, from the top of his head, a whole bunch of the stuff from the cantos. And his work is kind of like that. It sort of borrows from Pound, is indebted to Pound. He's a really interesting guy. So I'm looking forward to seeing him. I'd seen him in the past a couple of times when he came out to the University of New Brunswick. So I'm looking forward to seeing him again. I believe that will be tomorrow night in Toronto.
And you said it's going to be two days of this, and it's focused in Toronto. Is that the epicenter of the tour, or is it other parts of Canada too?
Well, it actually isn't focused in Toronto. One of the events is there.
Oh, okay.
But it's mostly focused in Hamilton, Ontario, which is, you know, sort of close to Toronto in the what we call the Golden Horseshoe around Lake Ontario. And it's part of, like I said, the collective is called the Abel Hamilton Collective. So it really is a Hamilton-based enterprise.
And it sounds like it's going to be an intense and wonderful couple of days. So even if you don't know people now, you'll know everyone pretty well by the end of this.
Yeah, I know. I'm actually quite excited to go to McMaster University in Hamilton, where I did my undergraduate degree. And I'll be presenting on a panel there about disability in the academy for the most part, and thinking also a little bit about New Brunswick writers and, you know, accessibility concerns in the province of New Brunswick in sort of smaller centers, that sort of thing. But one of the professors who teaches there, his name is Jeffrey Donaldson. You know, I studied with Jeffrey back like when I was, you know, in my early 20s, and he really got me started as a writer of poetry. Like, he sort of like fanned the flames. And since then, you know, I just sort of took off. And so I owe a great deal to him. So it'd be great to sort of present with him tomorrow afternoon at McMaster in the afternoon.
And so what not to make us, I guess, a spoiler alert, but are you going to be talking about like the state of things in academia regarding disability, Philip, or could you give us like a teaser?
No, absolutely. I mean, a lot of it has to do with partly, like I said earlier, is, you know, accessibility for disabled people in the province of New Brunswick. So I'll be talking a little bit about that.
What is accessibility like?
Well, the thing is that I come from a pretty large center in New Brunswick, the capital of the province, which is Fredericton. And I sort of feel like the accessibility there is actually quite good, and that the city's kind of pretty forward-thinking, and all of their new projects are going to definitely have accessibility in mind when they're developed. And they're probably, in all likelihood, as far as I understand it, in the business of sort of retrofitting everything else that, you know, hasn't been sort of earmarked for that. So in some ways, it's sort of hard for me to talk about what's going on in smaller centers, even though like Fredericton, New Brunswick is like 70,000 people, say. It's still one of the bigger urban centers in Atlantic Canada, even. So in terms of that, I probably have a little bit less to say. A little bit more to say about, you know, welcoming disability into the classroom and thinking about how it is that you accommodate people's needs and sort of helping them understand that, you know, it's a safe space and that they can, you know, communicate with me or communicate with any instructor. You know, there are sort of legal or official channels that you can go through in order to sort of get your accessibility needs met. Some people are nervous about doing that. Some people, you know, just don't know about it. And even in certain cases, you might try to do that and find that, you know, your needs aren't being met through official channels. And then I feel like, you know, then it's sort of on me, and I'm happy to be the person who advocates for just about any student. Like, I feel like I couldn't not do that considering my position.
Philip, what are there poems that speak that you can, like, is there a poem that you're going to be reading that connects directly to disability?
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
And not even laughter?
Yeah, I would say probably not so much in this book. Yeah, because I, over the years, really, my own disability is something it's taken me a long time to come to terms with. So I've sort of always written from a position of like sort of like within the dominant culture, in a sense, where like I tried to sort of like, you know, compartmentalize that and just sort of like write as if, you know, this hasn't happened to me or that I'm not writing from the subject position. So I found more and more lately that it's something that is a bigger concern in my writing. And I'm starting to sort of think about it more so now. But, you know, looking back at the work that I've done, there's really not a whole lot there that really speaks to that directly.
And do you have any of the new poems with you, Philip? Did you happen to have, do you have them in that blue bag there?
I'm afraid I really don't. And again, it's really something I'm just, it's just in a sort of gestational stage at this point. There's, you know, one poem that I wrote for my son that sort
for
of
Ben?
Gestures towards it. Yes, for my son, Benjamin, who was born here at the University of Michigan Hospital in 2008. Which is really cool. So we have our own little American.
And, that's right. Yeah. And Wolverine, is
yeah,
that, that's
absolutely.
Not going too far.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So he loves the idea of like being from here.
Aww.
So yeah, absolutely.
And so we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll be back to talk more with Philip Krimble and hear poems from his book, Not Even Laughter, out with Salmon Poetry of Ireland. The song we're going to hear is actually a Woody Guthrie song that you've got a poem in Not Even Laughter. And in the acknowledgments, it says, "This land is your land is based on an experience listening to WCBN, November 5th, 2008, and is dedicated to my son, Ben." So let's hear it. And then we'll be back to talk with Philip Krimble more.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass and Sarah as our studio audience. And today, Philip Krimble is here. His book, Not Even Laughter, out with Salmon Poetry, of the Cliffs of Moher.
Right? Yes, indeed.
Like, what? I can't think of a more beautiful place to have your book published.
That's pretty amazing.
Could you tell us a little bit about the song, why this one matters, why you chose it for today's show?
Well, it's as you mentioned earlier, in the note at the back, it talks about listening to this radio station that day. And again, based on an experience listening to WCBN Ann Arbor on November 5th, 2008, it's dedicated to my son, who was like a tiny child then. I mean, he was born in January 08, so he wasn't even a year old yet. And anyway, November 5th, of course, was the day after Barack Obama was elected president for the first time. So there was a lot of euphoria, and a lot of people felt like, especially after the George W. Bush government had ended, after that eight-year period, that we were in for something really remarkable. And I think we were in many ways. I was just sort of sad that we had to leave after a couple of years and not enjoy all of those 8 years worth of his presidency. But anyway, it just sort of made me think that I could see that people were so excited and they were playing all of these old songs instead of the stuff that they would normally play. And so it just felt like I wanted to sort of document that. So I'll go ahead and read the poem now if you would like. This land is your land. Our lunchtime ritual of porridge, jars of winter squash and sweet peas, organic rice rusks, college radio, and sunlight on the surface of the foam green kitchen table. Today, instead of slowcore, lo-fi ambient, or instrumental chamber pop, the kids are spinning vinyl, old left standards, union protest songs, and roots revival anthems from the Folkways label catalog. Phil Oakes and Judy Collins, early Dylan, Newport also Rans. My boy sits in the high chair, shifts and fidgets, holds out both his hands. I lift him to my shoulder, stop and listen to the old-time country picking, Woody Guthrie's magnum opus, like a whisper down a party line.
Thanks, Philip.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's so evocative of that moment.
Yeah, I think so. Well, thank you.
The kitchen, I feel like we can be there with you in that moment. And to think that WCBN had something to do with it.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, yeah, how long have you guys been going here? Like, since what, the 50s earlier?
Oh, I should know this off. I'm a bad institutional record of the place, but yeah, because I think we had like our 40th anniversary a while back. So yeah, we've been around in one way or another for a long time, and I may at last, because we just have increased our reach on the FM dial.
Right, I saw that.
So that's pretty exciting
that
as well.
That's great.
But so before we go any further, it occurs to me that I did not read any of your bio. And I know we've been filling in biography as we've talked, but I'll just read a short bit here before we continue, because there are a couple of things we missed. Philip Krimble was born in Belfast and emigrated to Canada with his family as a child. He holds two bachelor's degrees and in 2002 earned his MFA from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Go Blue, where he went on to teach for a number of years. Let's see. In 2007, he published a short collection with Lapwing and was selected to read in Poetry Ireland's annual Introduction series. Philip now lives with his wife and son in Fredericton, New Brunswick, where he divides his time between serving as a poetry editor for The Fiddlehead and pursuing a PhD in American literature at UNB. So those are those facts, right, Philip? All right. So music figures in to Not Even Laughter almost as much as film does.
Yeah, I would say that's correct.
Not that it's a competition.
No.
But it feels like, well, if it was a competition, film might be winning slightly because of how you chose to structure the book. Can you talk a little bit about like some of the nuts and bolts of Not Even Laughter and choices you made?
In terms of like sequencing it or putting it together, you mean? Yeah.
Yes. Well, and so, yeah. Let's
sure,
look at
absolutely.
It. Let's look at it for a little bit, because
yeah, I'd be happy to.
Because we've got sections. We've
yes.
got Luminology is the lead poem before the sections even begin. House Reel, Travelogue, Answer Print, and Title.
Okay, so all of those subsections have been titled using film terms, right? So a house reel is something that you would have in a cinema back in the day when they actually had reels. Travelogue is a kind of film, and an answer print is probably the one that people would maybe struggle with a little more. And that's the print that the director would give to the producers for them to okay before they went ahead and decided to make it sort of like the final print. So it's basically the director's print. It's the one that he or she is most satisfied with, or they are most satisfied with. And then it's sort of up to the producers to decide whether or not they're satisfied, the ones with the money. So I thought that was kind of an interesting title and an interesting term. And of course, one of the poems, in that section is also titled after it. And title is something that you often see in, soundtracks, like the soundtrack for a film. There's usually like an opening title and there's usually an end title. The end title is oftentimes a reprise of the opening title, sort of perhaps a softer version or a slightly different or an instrumental version or what have you. So it felt like end title seemed like the perfect way to close this, considering all of the other film references throughout.
And so is that why you chose those titles for the subheadings then, or subsections?
Yeah, it all had to do with film. And I mean, of course, the title of the book itself, Not Even Laughter, comes from a Robert Altman film. At least it comes from the music from that film. So,
there we go.
There's always a tie-in between the two, sort of like an intermarriage. And these things, you know, like the different kinds of media texts, in a sense, sort of speak to one another throughout this book.
And so Luminology is the poem that leads us off, but it's separated from the group.
Right. Yeah, well, it's a poem that I sort of see, and I did read this when I was at Literati last night. It was the first poem I read, and I felt that it's a good introduction to a reading. It's a good introduction to my own sensibility as a writer and the things that I'm interested in and perhaps even obsessed with. So it's basically, in a sense, a kind of ars poetica, and it's about sort of like really saying that you don't care about something, like almost protesting too much about something, right? It's like, no, this doesn't matter to me. No. But in the end, it means everything. So in a sense, the poem does that. And it's sort of like almost sort of makes fun of like, oh, well, why would you be so sort of like mesmerized by all of these things in the natural world? And yet the reality is that these are the things that sort of captivate us. These are the things that work on our imaginations, at least they do on mine. And, you know, I didn't really want to apologize for that. So in a sense, I felt like the poem sort of said, these things do matter, and they matter to me, and they matter to my poetry.
And so when you were drafting this poem, Philip, maybe you want to read it for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Since we're talking about it.
Sure.
And so when was that a natural to say no, like it doesn't matter, to assert that it does? Was that something natural? Was that in it from the very beginning? Or is that something that you found because you do care so much about, and sometimes it's hard to be earnest.
Yes.
In poems.
It is. It's hard to get away with it or to do it right. Yeah. I mean, I think we need a lot more earnest as far as I'm concerned in poetry. But it needs to be artful as well, I think, in order to make it art. And that balance is a really hard one to achieve sometimes. Yeah. And in terms of the way I wrote this poem, I think I began with "It doesn't mean that much to me." And I wasn't sure where it was going. As with most of my poems, you know, I just followed the direction in which I'm headed. And, you know, I always think about Robert Frost. And one of his favorite sayings was, "It is but a trick poem and no poem at all when the best of it is thought of first and saved to the last." And that's something I've sort of always lived by. And, you know, if I know how a poem is going to finish before I even start writing it, then it's sort of like, you know, it does a disservice to the poem. It feels sort of like just a sort of mechanical way of getting towards something you've already decided on.
It's not as alive.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not saying you can't write that like that. A lot of people do. And a lot of people write really excellent poems that way. But for me personally, it's a process of discovery.
Amen to that, Philip. Yeah.
So shall I read it now? Is there time?
That would be great.
Okay. So this is called Luminology. "It doesn't mean that much to me. People on a trampoline. Their roadside garden. Sunlight. Grades of summer green. All chosen as if entries in a catalog. Field notes leave me wondering what we're afforded. Is it plain to see? Faint laughter. Open motion caught. A beat-up truck. Enough to please. Enough to make the tablecloth the women shake out thoughtlessly toward the fields seem golden. Mist as fine as chalk dust on the cornrows now, a slow explosion settling. It travels down the furrows, twists and breathes the night, moves deeper still. Fireflies crowd the underside of leaves, lay eggs, cast yellow protein light that glistens in the nebula. New constellations burning free, a backdrop, but I'm one to talk. It doesn't mean that much to me. It doesn't."
Thanks, Philip.
My pleasure.
So now we know what means a lot to you, basically. You've just told us, everyone.
The secret's out.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, maybe Philip will tell us more secrets. Today on Living Writers, Philip Krimble is here. His book of poems, Not Even Laughter, out with Salmon Poetry of Ireland. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
We
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Philip Krimble is here in the studio. His book of poems, Not Even Laughter. Can you tell us a little bit about the song and why you picked it for today, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. This is this is a song that I've taken a lyric from as the epigram that sort of opens a collection of my poetry, and it is: "We sleep in the mornings, we dream of a ship that sails away 1,000 miles away." And I was always fascinated by this little lyric, and I mean, more than anything else, it's the song itself that always captured my imagination. And it has a sort of hymnal quality, something. And Brian Eno is a really interesting guy. I don't know how much your listeners may know about him, but he basically pioneered the ambient sort of sound in music with Music for Airports that came out in 1977. And this was made right around the same time. And he was, you know, he was interacting with some of the German experimental musicians at the time. And they were sort of forging this music together in many ways. And I mean, in some ways, I think he actually stole from them. But it was a collaboration as well. But this comes from an album that was the very last album that he sang on for a long time. Because I think he sort of moved away from the human voice because he felt like it was doing him a disservice. His own voice is quite lovely, I think. But I'm not sure he felt it was. And I also don't think that he just felt the human voice in general was something he wanted to be working with. So he moved more towards just soundscapes. But you could see it in this song that clearly, like, that hymnal quality, that ambient wash is something that's very present and sort of like really sort of is sort of the propulsive force in the song more than anything else, certainly more than the voices. But it's hard for you to sort of like just put down musical notes as an epigram, so I had to put down something from the song. But I still felt like...
And it'll lead people to it.
Yeah.
Because I played it.
Yeah.
Because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. It's so hard to make sense of it. We sleep in the mornings. What does that mean? I mean, does it mean you're sleeping in the mornings? Why would you do that? You know, you sleep at night, obviously. We dream of a ship that sails away in the morning, 1,000 miles away. You know, there's just something so... There's something magical about that, something almost sinister as well. I don't know. I get a slightly sinister feeling like we're dreaming of this.
So far away.
Yeah, it's sailing off into like maybe a sort of like maybe it's his own voice sailing off into the ambient space that he went on to explore. But I just felt like it was one of those passages that I could never really get to the bottom of. And that sort of pleased me in some ways because I don't want to know everything. I mean, there aren't, you know, solid answers to everything. So this becomes sort of a puzzle that sort of perpetually regenerates itself.
And by choosing the music and then these particular lyrics from the song, Philip, then you've also given us this as like a layer to interpret Not Even Laughter as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it sort of has the tone. And definitely the song itself has the tone that it's sort of like a thread that gets pulled through the book, like a kind of like there's a bittersweetness to it that's common to most of what I write. So I felt like it just sort of established that right from the beginning.
So I find it interesting that you said the ominous quality or sinister. Did you say sinister?
I said sinister.
You said sinister, but ominous is like, I think, the last word in one of the poems in the theremin, I think.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
There's a little bit of this throughout Not Even Laughter.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think, you know, if you think about it, definitely the title poem itself, that really comes through there. And it's sort of like this notion of trying to figure out, you know, where you're going. I'd be happy to read it if you'd like me to. And this is a poem that, even though it's the title poem of the collection, it's one I seldom read, you know, in a public reading, because I think maybe you need to, You need to know a little bit more about the film, perhaps, but I don't know. I don't think you really need to know that much other than, you know, it's a revisionist Western. It's about a lady who was like a madam of a brothel and a sort of like a cowboy who was not really a conventional cowboy in any way and really was trying to run a business and trying to run a town and didn't really know what he was doing. And their lives sort of come to an abrupt halt at the end. It's a really interesting film, and I can't do it a service by talking about it here. You really need to see it. But Leonard Cohen's Stranger Song, it begins the film. It's at the opening credits. I believe it ends it as well. So that, of course, features in the poem. So I'll go ahead and read it. Now, it's actually a fairly short poem, and it sort of hinges more than anything else on the last sentence. So not even laughter. The snow that buries John McCabe was scripted to be heavy rain. The picture's final scenes bleed seamlessly together. Constance Miller spent on opium. The fatalism of the film so thick it always makes me think of Bruegel's Icarus. Surrender must be improvised. The freedom to be open to invention leaves us little choice. It's like the shelter Leonard Cohen is so lonely for. His stranger song parsed out between the background sounds and dialogue. Another tired man lays down his hand. The camera rolls, but cannot know the burden it must capture. I wonder what it is I am after.
Thanks, Philip.
You're welcome.
So, poet, what are you after in titling the collection, Not Even Laughter? Like, when did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about the notion of negation, right? And of course, it pulls through immediately to luminology. It doesn't mean that much. Not even laughter. Of course, Not Even Laughter is one of the lyrics from Leonard Cohen's his song, from his Stranger Song. So I lifted that. And I remember, you know, when I first came up with this title, my friend Ryan Flaherty, who was in my cohort in the MFA program, said, you know, that's perfect for you with this whole idea of like negating things and asserting them and negating them at the same time. And so I think he probably knew me pretty well at that point. We spent a lot of time together. So he felt like, yep, that's the one. That's the right one for this. So you could see I'd had the title for the collection for quite some time, and it took just quite a while for the book to come out. I probably wrote this poem maybe around 2006, 2007, yeah. But, you know, I wonder what it is I'm after. You know, it's a case where I do, and I still do, and that's why I write, because I don't know what I'm after, but I'd like to know. But the idea is that, you know, it's all about the process of trying to find the, you know, what it is you're after. And in the end, even if you find something that you think is close to that, it typically leaves you with more questions than answers.
Which reminds me of your poem, Answers to Seamus.
Answers to Seamus, yes.
Which is so... a great one. But not to skip ahead onto another poem, but I think, so this is, it's like this writing to discover this idea of a search, is a serious one for you. It's like the life's work.
Yeah. It's like being a detective. Like I'm trying to uncover clues to figure out where it is I'm supposed to be going next. Right. And if it feels right, it feels right. But a lot of it also has to do with the music. So like there's a musicality to all of my writing and I build it in and I can't help myself. And I sometimes have like what I feel is like maybe even a perfect image. It's like, oh, right, this is going to work out well, but I can't get the music right. So I have to abandon it. So maybe I use it somewhere else. But if the music's wrong for me, it's a big problem. One of my poetry heroes is the Washington poet Richard Hugo, and he was all about sound. And it's like, if you make this sound, you need to make it again like seven syllables later. And if you don't, then it's going to cripple the poem in a sense, or like make it really stultified. And it's like, yeah, I believe in that. And it needs to have that sort of internal rhythm. And sounds need to answer each other in specific places in order for the music to be right. And if they don't, then I can tell right away.
I'm so happy that you mentioned Richard Hugo. And it makes me think, how did we not talk about this way back in, was it 2007 when we spoke, Philip?
Yes, it was.
Because I used to work at Richard Hugo House in Seattle. And so Richard Hugo, I have fond, and Triggering Town is, I think, a really excellent book. Don't let your teachers or your writing teachers tell you anything, really, in some ways, or trust yourself. But I love this what you're talking about. Hugo had a lot to tell us as students of his poems, or in people who enjoy reading poems. So is there one of your poems where you can look at the musicality of some of the language that comes to mind off the top of your head to illustrate what you we're just talking about, Philip? Or is it more in the drafting process
I think, like,
it's got to be there at the end, obviously.
Yeah, but. Well, it's in the drafting process. I mean, I can't, there's, you know, a lot of people write like, you know, here's my first draft and, okay, I'm going to winnow things away or build things on or put this here. I can't really do that. My revision process is one that takes place as the poem is being composed. So what tends to happen is I'll have, like, maybe say I've got working on a couple of lines at the top of the page. There'll be like maybe as many as like, you know, 15 or 20 lines of poetry beneath that. That's all just sort of rough work. So like every time I have finish a poem or feel like it's complete, there's a poem that's like maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 14 and 20 lines long. And then there's probably like seven pages of notes that are just like blasted right beneath it that sort of like stay in the archive of that poem in a sense. So that's always, the rough work's always there. So everything that I've ever done in terms of putting a single poem together is always captured within that document. And the finished poem sits on top of it, all the rough work sits beneath it. So the revision process for me is one that takes place incrementally as I go forward painstakingly, like putting things together in tiny little packages.
And with the rough work, is it something that there might be an original drafted line and then you take it down, like you move it down the page, and then at the top of the page you have maybe parts of it still represented?
Well, no.
Or how,
yeah, it's all down there beneath, and it's like, yeah, oh right, it's like I go back like, you know, a week later, it's like, oh, this is what I was thinking about last month. It's like, oh yeah, you were thinking about this and it didn't quite work in this part, but, you know, maybe bring it up now and it works here instead, so a little later in the poem. So I have all of this sort of archive of material that I'd been thinking about that I felt belonged in the poem or could potentially belong there that I'm able to access. So I keep all of that material available for me.
And so it seems that would be interesting as a way to publish a book.
You could like have all of these rough notes underneath.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's possible. It'd certainly be a lot longer than a conventional poetry book would be because, you know, like I said, in some cases, I have like 10 pages of notes for a 14-line poem.
You should pitch it to someone.
Yeah. Well,
maybe. I mean, it's an interesting idea. Yeah. I think that would be a great idea for a book.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'd be like a posthumous thing or something.
Oh, yes. So cheerful. On that note, let's take a short break, but we will be back. We're coming back, folks. We're coming back today on the program. Philip Krimble is here. Not Even Laughter, his book of poems out with Salmon Poetry. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender.
was reaching for the sky just to surrender. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And then leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I came I was a stranger. I told you when I came I was a stranger. But now another stranger seems to want you to ignore his dreams as though they were the burden of some other. Oh, you've seen that man before, his golden arm dispatching cards, but now it's rusted from the elbow to the finger. And he wants to trade the game he plays for shelter. Yes, he wants to trade the game he knows for shelter. Oh, you hate to watch another tired man lay down his hand like he was giving up the holy game of poker. And while he talks his dreams to sleep, you notice there's a highway that is curling up like smoke above his shoulder. It's curling just like smoke above his shoulder.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Philip Krimble is here in the studio, Not Even Laughter, the book of poems with us. So we were talking earlier in the program about new poems that you've been working on, and you did bring a poem that's not in Not Even Laughter here with you. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one that I would like to read, and it's for my son, Benjamin. When he was quite small, when we were still living here in Ann Arbor, he was fascinated with this old ornithology that I picked up at the Don Treader for just a few dollars.
And Don Treader's still there.
Yeah, I was
not
there.
Not many bookstores. No. The bookstores are, we need to save them, Philip. Anyway, Don Treader.
We were in there the other day. It's still as it was, which is, you know, like kind of an organized catastrophe, but it's like amazing. So anyway, I picked this up there, like North American Birds, it was called, of course, and it's just one of these illustrated compendiums of birds from all over, like, the continent. And my son was fascinated by this, and when he was really small, we would flip pages, and he would be able to identify the names of the birds in a sort of crude way, like you could understand him slightly, but you knew that he was trying to say, like, the snowy owl. And he would get angry when you weren't turning to that page. Snowy, snowy, he kept asking for it. Sorry.
So he'd be like, I insist on the snowy owl.
Yeah, he wanted those things to come back again. Like, where did it go?
Huh.
But he knew just about all of them, and we were just, you know, taken aback at how much knowledge that he had. But then, you know, after a while, he lost interest and went on to other things that little kids like to do. And this poem's sort of like thinking a little bit about, nostalgically about, you know, that time and what it meant. And how, you know, how you have to grow up, but, you know, there's a little piece of that you always want to try and keep. So this is called North American Birds. A world is firstly made of names and labels. What the nascent heart is desperate to possess. For you, my son, the chickadees and finches at the feeding table, nesting in the eaves and calling each to each atop our backyard maple, filled the empty spaces in your head. Next came the illustrations, color plates you memorized by rote, the simple work of saying like a spell, a song of invocation. All winter long, our little house made warm by ornithophily, a reverence of words, the age-old human dream of flight. These days, toy trucks and robots dance like planets in your mind. Bird boy, must you leave so soon? Sit down with me and stay a while.
Thanks for reading that one, Philip.
My pleasure, and hopefully my son will be able to listen to it. I guess there's a podcast.
Yeah, so can, on the website.
I think he'll be excited. Oh,
yeah, shout out to
Benjamin.
Benjamin. Yeah. Don't forget the birds, Ben. Don't forget the birds. So that was a lovely one, Philip, and it's making me connect to things that I felt like hearing that poem. It feels like it could even be in Not Even Laughter. Although slightly more hopeful than some of the poems. No, I'm just kidding. There's hope in here. 'Cause many of what I noticed and what I thought was interesting as earlier in our conversation, when you said you're writing to discover and how you don't know the end, but you might be in a moment, and maybe it's a moment of making. But in reading Not Even Laughter, I feel like you bring readers to the moment of being somewhere, like in lyrical places. You make places lyrical. Some of them are in Ireland, and maybe Ireland gives you a head start, because Ireland is often lyrical somehow. Just like, but the poems that I think maybe take place in Ann Arbor or in places in Canada as well. So are you conscious of that? Like this making lyrical of place, or do you find that in the poems here?
I think so. A place is very important to me and my project as a writer. I think it's something that I always have in mind, and I find that a place can be inspiring. And of course, I mean, it's basically, you know, sort of you're projecting yourself in a sense. If you're talking about the lyric sensibility, you're projecting yourself onto these places and your life experience and, you know, whatever cultural imprint you might have had previously and cultural imprints from other places. The place itself becomes kind of like a blank canvas, and you're able to just sort of like pull things from it to sort of like create a, you know, sort of in the end, you're sort of creating an image of your own experience. And I think the place allows you to sort of do that without sort of speaking about yourself completely directly.
And that sort of connects into the use of the music within Not Even Laughter too.
Yeah, I suppose so. What do you mean precisely by that?
Well, precisely, I'm not sure about, but somewhere off to the side of it.
Yes.
I think it's that the use of music is evocative in conjuring a feeling or an experience as well. So when you're calling upon that in a poem, you're bringing that, if there is a known experience of that sensory to the poem itself, as you're creating a new experience within the framework of your poem experience.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. I think like the music does definitely play into the whole sort of lyric sensibility and how the landscape and how these, they're all sort of parts of like the same composition in a sense, I would say. So they all factor in. And for me, you know, music is the number one sort of like motivating factor, and I can't get past the sort of musicality. It's what drives me.
When you're drafting, Philip, when are you reading out loud or singing some of the lyric, or how are you working with it in the process?
Yeah, well, I am working that way. It's, you know, I will always read aloud, you know, as I've, it's like, okay, well, I finished that line or that sentence. And it's like, well, how does the sentence sound? And again, Robert Frost was like, loved this idea of the sentence sound. It's something that he sort of swore by. And, but it's not just the sentence sound itself, but it's how that sentence sounds against other sentences. And I tend to think in terms of sentences rather than in terms of lines. But I am really fastidious about how it is that that I break lines. And, you know, I am sort of more of a throwback. You know, my poems are sort of loosely formal. But breaking out a preposition or something like that or a conjunction isn't the kind of thing that I really tend to do, unless there's a really sort of obvious reason, or at least it's a reason that can be sort of like understood on some level. But I tend to sort of break on nouns and verbs if I can.
So trusting the shape of the music within to make the line.
So it can be
transform it.
It can be frustrating, and sometimes I'll have to sort of change line lengths in order to get them to look the way that I want them to. So a lot of it has to do with how the poem looks on the page as well. So I mean, I have an allegiance to that,
which goes back to the rough work.
Yeah, exactly. So if it doesn't look right, it gets pushed down the page.
So if you, but there's a place for it. I really think there should be some of these poems out in the world with their rough work, with their story.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only one who works in this way. I mean, I've got to imagine many, many writers do the same thing, that especially in the age of word processing.
Right.
I mean, like, it's, we're so able to save like vast quantities of information now. So I don't see why you wouldn't keep everything that you've been working on to try and arrive at your finished product.
Well, that's a bit of advice there for everyone, I think, as we're heading out. I thought this, we're at our time, Philip. I've loved talking with you. I thought we would talk a bit about football, maybe read one of the football poems or strawberries. There's lots
right.
of produce and flowers
lots of,
in here.
Groceries, markets.
Marigolds. Yeah. but I've loved it. Please come back again. And it's good. It's always good to see you.
It's great to see you too, T. Thanks so much for inviting me here today.
Anytime, Philip. So today on the program, Philip Krimble, his book, Not Even Laughter, out with Salmon Poetry. Check out the Living Writer's website for an episode archive. Ben will be listening to hear his poem soon. Also follow Living Writers on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks everyone for listening today. Thanks to Stephanie for engineering, for making us sound good. Thanks to Sarah for being our studio audience. Thanks to all of you out there for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.